Okay. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the One Wilt Call. This is Sandy Thacker from the East Bay in California. If this is your first time on a One Wilt Call, you are especially welcome. Our call norms and helpful directions for the call are posted on our text pad on the visual interface. You'll find our agenda and relevant links to extra resources there, too. If you are dialing in without a computer, you won't get to see the text pad.
Welcome, everyone. I'm call team member Ann Henney from the East Bay, California branch also. Thank you for joining us. If you have a technical issue, press 5 on your phone keypad, and Michael will help you out. And if you want to raise your hand to get on the stack during Q&A, press 1 on your phone keypad.
Is Shilpa's mic open?
Shilpa Pandey from California. We started this call with a powerful 4-minute video that we've had posted repeatedly on our Wilt US Facebook page. We are asking you all who are on SB to go on our Wilt US section Facebook page and share the video to your own personal Facebook page frequently during the next few weeks. The link is on the text pad. This video would be a great time to advertise the Hiroshima Day Solidarity event you're planning. So repost it frequently as we approach your planned Hiroshima event, and we'll hear more about those events you're planning right after a few short announcements. Our first announcement comes from Laura Dewey and the nominating committee. Laura, your mic is open.
Hi, this is Laura, and welcome to the call. I'm glad to see quite a few people on this call. As chair of the nominating committee, my job is to look for candidates to run for the board every year. We have rolling elections, which means that we have positions that open every single year. So they generally are 3-year positions, and you should have seen 2 e-alerts about them. And I want to just highlight a couple of things. Another e-alert will be going out probably around the 23rd because the position description on one of them was incorrect, and we're going to correct that. But what you need to know are the positions that are open, and that's on the e-alert. There are currently 7 positions. One of them is co-president, and just so you know, 2 people can run for president and serve as co-presidents. We've had that before, that model before. And that's always a possibility. The other positions are personnel chair and nominating chair, development chair. There's 2 at-large positions that will be open. And then the last one is a program chair position. I want to point out that if any of you know anybody who you think might be a good person on the board, go to the e-alert and you'll get there's a packet of information. There's a nominating form, too, and you can nominate somebody. If you yourself are thinking of running, but some people are hesitant, please give me a call. And I think Mary Beth is going to put my phone number on the text pad.
It is on there, Laura.
Very good. Okay. And I want to point out that 3 of these positions are, for different reasons, 1-year positions. Normally they are 3-year positions, but 3 of them are 1-year because they may have been vacant or they were recently vacated. And these are the at-large, the personnel chair, and the program chair. And the reason I point this out is because sometimes some people might want to just try sort of get their feet wet on the board. If they're not sure, they may have been thinking about it. But this is a great way to try out the board, to try out board service. You would be serving for 1 year if you took on any one of those positions. Another thing that I would recommend for people who are not quite sure, they're already active, but they're not quite sure if they want to be active on the national level, is to run for an at-large position. Because those positions, you can pretty much make of them what you want. And we do have some people who are active on a national level, like maybe they're already involved with the issue committee, and they would basically be able to just continue the work, the great work they're already doing, but make that sort of like their portfolio as an at-large member. Sorry. So, and I also want to point out that for three of the positions, which is president, the development chair, and my position, which is chair of nominating committee, the three of us who occupy those positions have agreed that we will be happy to assist or mentor any new person coming into our positions if they require that. So anyway, I want everybody to think about, A, people who are they might think might be good to run on the board, or B, whether that person might be yourself. So, and I always encourage people to email me, call me, if you have any questions, want to talk about what is life like on the board, serve as a board member, and I'd love to talk to any of you. So I think that's it for my time, and contact me if you have any questions. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Laura. There's a national action being planned around the child and immigrant detention issues for Thursday, July 26th. Nancy Price has details about how to get involved. Nancy, your mic is open.
Thank you very much. Hello, everybody. Of course, this is a topic that's so concerning for all of us, and especially for women and their children and families as they're being detained and their lives so severely impacted. Actually, there are three events that I would like to quickly announce. First of all, tomorrow at a variety of locations at detention centers, there are actions that you can find at this website address that I've just was just posted to the site, the HTTP bit.ly, where locations of detention centers will be available. And there are actions planned local time from 8 to 10 p.m. That will consist of a variety of types of actions, including banging on pots and pans to let the people know in the detention centers that there are people outside in solidarity with them, and to let you know that they're out there keeping watch and creating actions and trying to obstruct the actions of ICE, and also to occupy. This is an occupy action of ICE, and also to talk about the issues here in terms of Trump's policy and the administration policy. If you do not want to go to a detention center or don't know one where one is, you can go between 8 and 10 p.m. with some friends and other activists to either a local park or to local intersection and light candles and hold candles and have a discussion about what to do next, next steps to take. Then on the 20th, Friday the 20th, there will also be the same kind of action. And then on the 26th, as was mentioned, is a national day of action against ICE and against the administration immigration policies. This is the date of the deadline that the Trump administration was to unite families and children, and so that's a very important day. There will be more information available that we can post out to branches and members, perhaps on an e-alert, action alert, and also you can contact Michael Ippolito at michael@teamgood.org for more information, as well as going to the link that he just posted on the website. So I hope that that gives you some information that you can follow up on for the event tomorrow, the event on the 20th, and then planning to join the National Call for Action on the 26th. Thank you very much.
And I want to point out that there's some information, a link posted to the web to the text pad in green highlighting if you need more information about what Nancy just talked about.
Thanks, Nancy and Mary Beth. Now, our bylaws committee chair, Darian DeLue, could not be with us tonight, but she sent this announcement. Are you interested in clarity and precision in language? She asks. Do you want to contribute to the effective functioning of WILTS? If so, you're invited to learn more about the National Bylaws Committee. Please contact Darian at conjoin@sonic.net or telephone 916-739-0869. And I believe that information is on the text pad. Now,
right.
Mary Bricker Jenkins has another quick announcement for the WILTS for Poor People's Campaign Committee. Mary, your mic is open.
Hi, everybody. I hope you all are very proud of the fact that somewhere between 21 and 25 branches participated in the 40 days of action that culminated in Washington, D.C. on the 23rd of June. The kinds of participation ranged from making flyers to getting arrested. Everything in between and every single action was important. As Reverend Barber said on June 23rd in D.C., this is a movement, not a moment. And so the next thing that we are going to do within WILF is to assess where we've been, what we've done, and where we can go from here as part of building this movement. To that end, the Ad Hoc Committee on WILF for the Poor People's Campaign will meet tomorrow night, Friday the 13th, your lucky day, and Michael has kindly posted the information on the text pad for that call. It's Friday, July 13th at 7 p.m., and obviously the committee will be there, and we are inviting all who wish to participate in the assessment and planning going forward to join that call. If you don't have access to the text pad, you can email me at wilt4ppc@gmail.com. We will be, as I said, assessing where we've been and where we'll be going from here. There'll be a report of the July 23rd action at which several of the people who are on this call were present, either in D.C. or in their local communities. That will be coming out in the July e-news with lots of photos of the actions. So thank you very much. Be proud of yourselves, and I'll look forward to working with you in the future. Thanks.
Thanks, Mary, BJ. And thanks to all the branches who participated in those really wonderful solidarity events around the country. I have three announcements. The first one is from our development committee. We are seeking help to do some donor lead research. This is work you can do on your computer right from home, and it simply helps us identify progressive women donors to other causes that might also consider donating to WILF. If you can spare 3 to 5 hours a week, please contact me at mbgardam@gmail.com. My email is also on the text pad, mbgardam@gmail.com. This is work that some of your older or less mobile members can do. We'll train you. It's not hard, and it could yield really important help for funding our work. My second announcement is from the Corporations versus Democracy Issue Committee. Following a suggestion from the Burlington, Vermont branch, we'll be asking branches this fall to consider inviting the public in their communities to read and discuss a new book that was recently published. It's aimed at informing women about the economy in a very accessible and feminist style. The book is called Screwnomics: How Our Economy Works Against Women and Real Ways to Make Lasting Change. The author, Ricky Gard Diamond, appeals to the need women are recognizing to understand why they're not getting ahead financially and to their self-interest in figuring out solutions. She offers many of the practical, people-oriented solutions that WILF has been talking about for years. Diamond mentions WILF in the book, along with a heavy dose of material from our Challenge Corporate Power study course. But the book is a chatty, easy read that makes complicated concepts approachable. Our members probably know much of this material, but the public, especially younger women, may not know all the facts. We feel this book and the discussion it spurs could be an important introduction to the way the corporate power elite controls our democracy as well as our paychecks. The author has provided a study guide and workbook to use for further discussion, and she's encouraging us to form what she calls econo-girlfriends circles to read and discuss the book. It's a catchy concept that might just catch some interest in your area. The book is on the text pad. You can find more information at screwnomics.org. We see this as an opportunity to reach out more tangibly and in new ways to women in your community who are facing economic struggles. And by the way, that's mostly all of us these days. We'll be sending out more information about how to get started. Our study courses always brought increased recruiting to our branches, and this one could certainly help raise our profile in your community and bring you some new members too. WILF is all about informed activism.
Lastly, we're in the very beginnings of an exciting project, also suggested by the Vermont branch, to organize a national playwriting competition for authors of 10-minute plays about community activism that matters and women who make a difference. The planning committee is just launching and will be looking for volunteers. If you are a playwright yourself, or if you know one and would like to participate, they will be looking for judges and readers and folks to help shape the competition structure. We're looking at a launch date of early 2019 to announce the rules and application process. Contact Leslie Becker and Candace Perry if you are interested at plays@wilfus.org. This contest could raise WILF's visibility, connect branches to their local arts community, and attract new members to WILF. These are good examples of ideas that spring from members for enhanced outreach and activism. If you have ideas for projects, programs, events, or a One WILF Call topics, send them to us at onewilfcalls@gmail.com.
Okay, as many of you will remember, we voted on 3 solidarity events for 2018. Now the last of the 3 is approaching. In early August, we committed to standing together to mark the anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima. The video we showed at the beginning of the call reminds us how devastating an atomic weapon can be on a civilian population. And today, the atomic weapons we pay to create, storehouse, and maintain are far more powerful than the Hiroshima bomb, with much more devastating consequences for the whole world. It's appropriate for WILF members to loudly raise concerns in their communities on this anniversary and to link it to both the weapons rattling of our president and the principled stand of over 120 nations taken a year ago to sign a United Nations treaty to ban nuclear weapons. For this call, we asked WILF members for short 2-minute reports on what you are planning for the Hiroshima Remembrance events this year. We'll call on you and ask you to keep your reports short. We'll sound a gong at the end of your time. We want to get to as many of you as possible. Go ahead and raise your hand to get it on a stack by pressing number 5 on your phone keypad now. That's number 5.
I'm sorry, could you make that number 1, please?
Sure.
I typed in the wrong number. Sorry.
Oh, okay. Number 1 on your phone keypad. So if you want to get on the stack, please press number 1 on your phone keypad now. While you're doing that, I'll just remind you to be sure during these events to carefully record sign-ins with plans for timely and effective following up with the attendees. And to circulate the Disarm Committee petition to raise support for the U.S. to sign the UN treaty to ban nuclear weapons. Mary Beth, do we have a stack?
We're getting there. We have five people on stack so far, six people on stack so far. So let's start right in with Joan Goddard. Joan, I think your mic is open.
Yeah, I was the last one to do that, so I'm not quite catching my breath here. Okay, I was intentionally waiting for other people because all I can say is that we're getting together on July 20th to plan what we're going to do in August, and we are making signs on the 20th. We're going to be together in the afternoon in one of our members' backyards, and we'll be working on a bunch of things, including looking towards what to do in addition to using the petitions and to making signs and so on and so forth. So I was trying to be after other people who have wonderful things to report, but no, I got called on first. So there you are. Okay, that's it.
I'm sorry, Joan. Cheryl Spencer from Palo Alto branch in California. Can you give us your update?
Happily. I can't see Roberta on the stack. So Roberta Alquist is our main person on this. So we have booked the community room at a local library that we've used before for the evening of Monday, the 6th of August, to show a documentary called Atomic Homefront about an area in St. Louis, Missouri that's it's a residential area, is very close to a large landfill called Westlake Landfill, which contains radioactive waste. And it's a 50-minute documentary about, you know, what happens around atomic weapons and the use of nuclear stuff. So we've got the room for 3 hours. We expect to tell people to come. So it'll be a two-hour meeting and 50-minute documentary. We will, you know, have some discussion. And having seen that 4-minute documentary you showed from the BBC, if that's available on the, well, I think it is available on the web, we may show that to begin with. So we will do our, you know, this is something, the format we've done before. The Palo Alto people are very happy to come out and be educated about various issues. And so it's a format we've used successfully in the past on issues.
Okay, great. Thank you, Cheryl. Marcia Heath from Santa Cruz branch.
Yes, hi. So in the last year or two when we've done it, the UNA took the lead, and they're working with Veterans for Peace to plan the event, and we are co-sponsoring. And the event last time was really wonderful. They had it was at the collateral damage statue. It included lots of fine speakers and music, and they are taking the lead again, and we are co-sponsoring and sending it out to our to our membership. And Joan, you're invited with your Santa Cruz folks to come down, and we think at this time it's going to be August 11th.
The San Jose people, you mean? Yeah.
Yes, the San Jose people. If you don't, you know, just when you have your meeting, see if people would like to come down to Santa Cruz that day, and I'll keep you posted. Joan is on our mailing list, so every time we send out an event notice, she gets it, and we're in communication that way, so she will be able to pass that along to her folks when they meet and see if they want to come down and join us in Santa Cruz.
Great. That sounds wonderful. Thanks, Marcia. Peggy Olson from Monterey. Monterey is always doing so much.
Well, you can hear me.
Yep.
Yes. So actually, the Hiroshima event we've done for 14 years. This is our 14th year. It's our most successful event. We call it the Peace Lantern Ceremony. We get 100 to 200 people, and we have it 2 hours on it. This year it will be August 4th, Saturday, 7 to 9, Lovers Point Beach. We're very lucky to have a calm bay that we can put rafts on and tow lanterns around the bay. So the first hour we have taiko drummers and lantern making. So we have white paper bags that children and adults write peace messages, drawings, anything they want to on. We insert cardboards with a nail in them and tea candles, and then these are put on. We have four rafts that are towed by kayaks around the bay, and the lanterns get put on the cardboard. They're cardboard and foam floats that we made and we saved year after year. And once lanterns are made, then we have about half an hour of speakers. We have five or six. We get the mayor of Pacific Grove to speak, and we talk about Mayors for Peace, which demands was instituted by Hiroshima and Nagasaki mayors, and they're demanding that money for war go to people's needs. And we spoke to the Monterey City Council this year, and we got Monterey to join. So we're thrilled that our chapter has gotten both Pacific Grove and Monterey to join other cities for Mayors for Peace. And this gives us a wonderful chance to speak to the community about the need to end nuclear weapons and war, of course. And as dusk falls, we launch our rafts, light the candles, launch the rafts to music of the shakuhachi Japanese flute. And it has a beautiful, powerful impact on the community, so we get people returning every year.
Thank you, Peggy. I can't, every time I hear about one of these vigils where they launch little ships or do the lanterns at dusk, it just sounds so beautiful and powerful. Next is Satue Otara from Boston Branch. Welcome, Satue. I think your mic is open, is it, Michael?
Hi, sorry, I think I pressed it by mistake.
Oh, do you have a report from Boston for us?
No, actually I don't. I'm a new member and haven't really been able to make, you know, contact with them yet. So I pressed the one. I apologize.
Well, welcome.
Thank you.
That's okay. We welcome you as a new member. We're glad you're on the call and listening to what our branches are up to. Next is Lucy Lewis from Triangle, North Carolina branch.
Hi. We are going to be working with the Orange County Peace Coalition. We're actually taking the lead in doing a film showing on Thursday, August 9th at our local public library in the community room. It's called The Coming War on China. It's by Australian journalist John Pilger. And although it talks about the military, U.S. military buildup in the Pacific, there's a significant part that talks about how the Marshall Islanders were used in the 1940s as guinea pigs by the United States to test radiation. And then it also includes footage on the current resistance to U.S. military buildup and nuclear weapons in Okinawa and Jeju Island in South Korea. And we'll be meeting next week to plan our publicity and outreach with the rest of the Orange County Peace Coalition.
Great. Thank you very much, Lucy. It's remarkable you're able to do that with all of the organizing. Well, it's remarkable we've all been able to do this with all the organizing we've been spending on, our energy we've been spending on the Poor People's Campaign. These are three solidarity events that came pretty close together. So good job, everybody. And lastly, I have Blanca Gerard on the stack. Blanca, your mic is open. Blanca, are you on? Oh, there you are. Welcome.
Blanca? Now, this is Anandi Kimmel. Blanca Gerard couldn't participate this evening, but I'm a member of the Essex County branch of WILF, Essex County,
cool.
New Jersey, that is. And
welcome, Amanda.
Thank you. We've been very busy planning a voter workshop on July 25th, which will involve every aspect of the voting process. And then we've also been busy with the Poor People's Campaign, and Blanca was a marshal on a number of marches which were held in Trenton. And because of this, we haven't really done too much with, the Hiroshima Remembrance Day, but we are working on that now. And last year we had a table in the center of Montclair, and we distributed flyers and also had people making peace cranes, which we distributed to local legislators, the state legislators, and little garlands with these peace cranes. And we hope to, expand on that this year, but it's still a work in progress. And I'm very interested in this immigration movement on the 25th. Is that in the daytime also? Hello?
Nancy, can you answer that?
Pardon?
Nancy Price, can you answer that question?
Yes, do you hear me?
Yes,
okay, so it is on the 26th. And
oh, the 26th, I'm sorry.
Yes,
okay.
That's okay. And it would be from 8 to 10 p.m. local time.
Oh.
And will, with Michael Ippolito and Mary Beth, we will write an action alert with more details once those are solidified, and we'll send out information so people can organize.
Oh, good. Okay. All right. I was just wondering, because we're having that workshop on the 25th, but this is on the 26th. Then.
Yes. You'll have information by then.
Yes. I'm very concerned about this. It's really been, had a very depressing effect on me.
Yes.
I'm just very worried about all these kids.
Yes,
and everybody is. But anyway, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Amanda. We have picked up two more folks, Sandy Thacker. And
Mary Beth. Mary Beth, that was a mistake. I didn't mean to push it.
Oh, okay. And Deb Livingston from Tucson, Arizona branch. Hold on a second. Deb, I think your mic is open.
I have, maybe I'm the one. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Yes, my name is Georgia, and Deb is our leader of our group here in Tucson. I just wanted to add a few seconds about what we're going to be doing. It's just really delightful to hear what's happening with other groups. We're going to have an all-woman speaker on our event. we're focusing on the inner child this time. We're not going to have a whole lot of intellectual input in the speakers this time. We're going to have a woman who ran for mayor at one time a couple years ago, and she's going to read an essay, and we're going to have a woman from Physicians for Social Responsibility talk about Back from the Brink, two veterans for peace, women. One is going to speak about anti-militarism, and the other will be Hope for Children's Peace. That's the title of our event, actually, Hope for Children's Peace. And then I'm going to be speaking on the abandoned uranium mines in the Four Corners area here in Arizona. And then we're going to have a film made by a Tucsonan. It was made in the 80s, and it's quite exceptional. It's kind of almost a spoof because it's still true. A lot of interviews about what people are trying to do to build shelters. It's just the fear that is so evident in all these interviews. So we're going to have a really interesting program. I just wanted to add that.
All right. Thank you very much, Deborah. I think that's all we have time for. I wanted to be sure that we called on as many people as we could. It's exciting to see how many of us will be standing together as One Wealth this August. Raised this warning about nuclear disaster and more endless war. Thank you all for your work on all of this.
Okay, so right now I want to introduce our own Nancy Price, convener of the Earth Democracy Issue Committee, who has also been our representative to the planned Close the U.S. Bases work. Nancy has an excellent article coming out soon in the New Peace and Freedom magazine that looks at the history of the Pan-African movement in the context of holding this Wilth International Triennial Congress in Ghana. At a time when Africa is experiencing momentous conflict and opportunity, the theme of the Congress is building a feminist peace movement. Nancy, please tell us more. Your mic is open.
Thank you, everybody. Well, it gives me great pleasure to welcome to the call tonight Maurice Kani. I met Maurice at the No Foreign Bases Conference in Baltimore, where he was a panelist on the session called AFRICOM, the Invasion of Africa. So this might in the near future be a solidarity event that Wilth US might engage in, as we hear from him about what is going on in Africa from many points of view. That is from the kind of intersection of movements and issues that Wilth is very familiar with, challenging and developing resistance to and support of. Maurice, as he and I were talking today, sent me an email saying that his passion and purpose in having co-founded the Friends of the Congo is to contribute to the elevation of the condition of people of African descent throughout the globe. This comes, he's well schooled, you might say, after years of guidance and consultation with his Congolese mentor, Dr. Alafuete M. Kalala, former member of Parliament of Congo from 2003 to 2006, and a former presidential candidate. Currently, Maurice is not only the co-founder of Friends of the Congo, but executive director, and he also describes himself as an entrepreneur, a human rights activist, and he's worked with Congolese for two decades in their struggle for peace, justice, and human dignity. It's with great pleasure that I welcome you to this call, Maurice. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you. Thank you, Nancy, for inviting me and Friends of the Congo to come and speak to Wilth. I'd like to thank Michael as well for extending the invitation to us. And, of course, my colleague, Ajamu Baraka of the Black Alliance for Peace, for suggesting that I share with Wilth the work that Friends of the Congo is doing, and what has been unfolding on the African continent. I want to make sure that I'm speaking loudly and that everyone's able to hear me. That's fine.
Sounds good, Maurice.
Okay, great. Well, tonight, just going to share a broad overview of what has unfolded on the African continent and over the past half a millennia and where we are today and what's occurring, especially as it relates to the youth movements on the African continent that are continuing the fight for self-determination and liberation, a fight that the independence heroes of the 1950s and 60s initiated. In order really to understand what's unfolding on the continent, just broadly, we certainly have to look at the last half a millennium, the last 500 years, and begin with the period of enslavement, where in the 1400s, when European nations first encountered Africa and set off the European slave trade, although not the only trade that took place on the continent, the Arab slave trade, but the European slave trade was most consequential, particularly as it relates to the development and maturity of capitalism. And in the period where from mid-1400s to the 1800s, we saw witnessed millions of Africans being shipped to the so-called New World, mainly from the Central African region, from the Congo region. The Emory University developed what they call the Transatlantic Slave Trade Database. And for people who'd like to delve more into that, there's a website, slavevoyages.org, SlaveVoyages.org, where they document the extraction of Africans from the continent to the so-called New World. And this push to the New World, and some of you who are in the faith community may be familiar, was driven by a philosophy expressed in what they call the doctrine of discovery, where explorers rationalize their appropriation of indigenous lands by claiming that as long as those lands are not under Christian leadership, then they have the right to those lands. And that doctrine of discovery was a very powerful philosophical thrust that it actually came from out of Pope Alexander VI in 1493 is where its origins are. And it manifests itself today in our global trade laws. That same principle that the resources of the global South really don't belong to the people, but it belongs to those who, in the hundreds of years ago, those who quote-unquote discovered, and today to those who have the machinery and technology to exploit it. We see what has unfolded on the African continent is a story of plunder. And that plunder is central to the development of modern-day capitalism. In fact, there is no capitalism as we know it without slavery or the stolen labor of Africans. And Eric Williams documented this well in a book entitled Capitalism and Slavery. And also we have the Harvard professor Sven Beckert, who came out with a recent book entitled Empire of Cotton, A Global History, where he he amasses a battery of data and demonstrate the centrality of slavery and slave labor to the development of capitalism. So early on, we see the hundreds of years of the extraction of resources from the African continent, fueling the development of Europe and the West. Initially, of course, it was in the form of human body, human bodies. I was in West Africa, in Ghana, and I know the conference is, your conference is going to be held in Ghana. I was on the slave coast in Elmina, and in the slave dungeons, I hope that when you do go, that there is a some opportunity for you to make a trip to the Cape Coast and to those slave dungeons, because it's a really transformational experience where you actually walk through the dungeons and see how Africans were hoarded into those dungeons and then shipped out to the West, not for a few years or a few decades, but for centuries. And even as the Dutch and the Portuguese and the British fought each other, they actually went to war against each other, the slave, the extraction of Africans continued in order to fuel the development of the West. So I hope during the conference in August that you have an opportunity to go to the Cape Coast and visit some of those dungeons. It's an experience that will be it's an indelible, it'll leave an indelible imprint on you, for sure. The now, I don't want to give the impression that there was no resistance. From the very outset, on the African continent and in the so-called New World, you had resistance movements, whether it was the resistance that we find in Jamaica with Maroon societies, or in Brazil, which received the largest contingent of Africans, one of the largest, if not the largest contingent of Africans, with the Quilombos that were established there. And even here in the United States, Maroon societies and a host of so-called slave rebellions. So there was consistent resistance. And that's one thing that you find on the in the experience of Africans, both on the continent and on abroad, the resistance to oppression, the pursuit for freedom, the pursuit for liberation, the pursuit for justice. These are consistent themes throughout. Now, even as the slave trade came to an end, whether in the mid-1800s, like 1833 in England, 1865 in the U.S., in Brazil, 1888, that didn't stop the pilfering of the African continent. There was a new phase that was ushered in, known as, initiated by the Berlin Conference in 1884 and 1885. So now you had 14 European nations and the United States who gathered in Berlin in order to determine what they were going to do with what they call the Great African Pie, this tremendous wealth in natural resources that existed on the African continent. So in an effort to prevent European powers from going to war against each other, they gathered in Berlin and established their spheres of influence on the African continent. So that's why today you'll see some parts of Africa, they speak French. As in the case of Ivory Coast or Togo or Central African Republic or the Republic of Congo, they and other places they speak Portuguese, like in Mozambique or in Guinea-Bissau or in Angola. They speak Spanish in Western Sahara or in Equatorial Guinea. Or German in Namibia or on the coast in Tanganyika in near Tanzania. So it all are English in Nigeria and Ghana. So they established their spheres of influence and carved up the continent under the guise of what they call the three C's. They said they were, the Europeans were bringing civilization. They said they were bringing Christianity, if you had to convert the heathens, or whether they're bringing commerce. So under these three principles, they are able to conquer the African continent. And probably the most egregious example of this phase of European plunder occurred in the Congo itself. The Congo was so big, so rich, that it wasn't given to any one European power as a colonial outpost. Instead, it was given to King Leopold II of Belgium as his own personal property. He owned it outright, and they call it the Free Congo State. Free meaning that European powers had freedom of commerce and freedom of movement in the Congo region. Meanwhile, the king was extracting ivory and rubber. Rubber was critical at the time in the late 1800s because Dunlop had developed a pneumatic tire in Europe, and the bicycle and automobile were coming online, so that rubber was needed to fuel the industry in the West. And as a result of the extraction of this rubber, the Congolese population was decimated by half. An estimated 10 to 15 million Congolese lost their lives as a result of the plunder of the Congo. And Adam Hochschild, in his book, King Leopold's Ghost, does an excellent job of documenting this plunder of the Congo. And it, for all intents and purposes, represents the first genocide, really, at the dawn of the 20th century, even though it wasn't, it hasn't been recognized by scholars or it's rarely spoken of. So this started off this Berlin Conference, produced the colonial era, which lasted till the 1950s and 60s, where during the colonial era, we saw a series of resistance, especially outside of the African continent, too, where there was a little bit more freedom on the part of people of African ancestry, where they, starting in 1900, organized what they call Pan-African conferences, a series of conferences organized in primarily in Europe and certainly here in the United States, calling for the European powers to free their colonies, to provide, to turn over those colonies back to the Africans. But it wasn't until after World War II that we saw a weakened Europe and its inability to hold on to its colonies, the rise of the independence movements, starting in January 1, 1956, with Sudan being the first African nation to gain its independence, and then followed by Ghana, is March 6, 1957. And the Ghanaian independence was particularly significant because it was Kwame Nkrumah, who had gone to school here in the United States at Lincoln University, had engaged with figures such as W.E.B. Du Bois, who was a student of great Pan-Africanists like Marcus Garvey, and worked with a range of Pan-Africanists from different parts of the African world, from the Caribbean, from the U.S., from Africa. And it was that in the independence of Ghana where Nkrumah said that Ghana is not free until all of Africa is free. And that control of the Ghanaian state assisted other African nations in their liberation, probably most notably in Guinea, who was colonized by the French, and the French had given its colonies an option to either stay with France or go on your own. And Guinea decided that it was going to go on its own, and France was vexed. France was led by de Gaulle at the time, and de Gaulle had made a tour of Africa to convince the French colonies to remain under French rule. And Guinea said they wanted out. And what the French did, they went in and they took everything out of Guinea. They took the bathrooms out. They took everything. If anything was nailed down, they would unhook it and take it out. And it was Ghana under Nkrumah that came in and provided Guinea with a $10 million or $20 million loan in order to sustain its independence. So you see a burgeoning of independence movements and liberation movements in the 1960s. However, the European powers reluctantly provided independence, but they did not want to give up on the structural relationships. That is to say, the control of African economies. And as a result of their desire to hold on to Africa's wealth and continue to pilfer the wealth of Africa, what was unleashed in the French zone, the French sphere, where you had the French colonies, particularly in West Africa, was what they call France-Afrique. And France-Afrique basically entailed the violent removal of African independence heroes, whether we're talking about Félix Moumier in Cameroon or Olympio in Togo. And the U.S. also got in on the game as well. Its largest covert action in the world leading up to at the time in the 1960s was its covert action against Patrice Lumumba in the Congo to overthrow the newly democratically elected prime minister and install a dictatorship in the Congo for another three decades from 1965 to 1997. So what we saw following the independence movement was the violent overthrow of and assassinations of African leaders. And it's interesting because it mirrored the violence that was waged against civil rights leaders here in the U.S. as well, with the assassination of Medgar Evers in Mississippi, the assassination of Dr. King, assassination of Malcolm X. So it was an onslaught on those who fought for civil rights, those who fought for human rights, and those who fought for freedom, to the point where today, for all intents and purposes, the governments on the African continent are neo-colonial regimes. That is to say, the leaders, they serve the interests of the metropole, of the European powers, of the United States, as opposed to serving the interests of their own people. And probably the last holdout in this independence drive was Thomas Sankara of Burkina Faso, who came into power in 1983 and 84, and ruled Burkina Faso with incredible results in terms of protection of the land, access to education for women, food self-sufficiency for the population. And it was through a French agent and a close partner of Sankara, Blaise Compaoré, that the French instrumentalized them to assassinate Sankara and put an end to really the independence and self-determination movement that we saw from the 60s right up to the 80s on the African continent. And today, where we are today on the continent is really where we were 500 years ago in principle, in that the pilfering of the natural resources of the African continent, the oil and the gold and the diamonds, continues. And probably the best example, one of the best examples of this plunder is in the Congo itself, because as a result of the plunder in the Congo, from 1996 to the present, an estimated 6 million Congolese have lost their lives. The deadliest conflict in the world since World War II. But there's the attention that's given to it is not commensurate with the scale and the scope of the tragedy that's unfolding. And at the bottom of this tragedy, the tremendous loss of life, we see here again the extraction of natural resources. Congo has a mineral called coltan, and it's a colloquial term. The scientific term is columbite tantalite. Once this mineral, it has one of the largest reserves of the mineral in the world. Once this mineral is refined and processed, it has two characteristics. It retains electric charge really well, and it's heat resistant. And what that does is it allows technology manufacturers to build smaller devices, but make them even more powerful. So I don't know if you remember when cell phones first came out, they were huge. You could, and if you held them up to your ears too long, they would heat up. That doesn't happen anymore. Now they're smaller, they don't heat up, and they're more powerful. They're like miniature computers in your hands. So one U.S. senator, I think it was Brownback, former senator, said that every American has at least one device in which coltan is found. You know, it's found in your heart pacer. It's found in the automobile engines and suspension brakes. It's found in instruments in jet planes. It's certainly in your cell, one of the key elements for your cell phone, video games that your children or grandchildren play. It's like a wonder resource. And a new mineral that's coming on this, that's been on the scene that's tied into the green energy industry is a mineral called cobalt. And cobalt, Congo has the largest reserves of cobalt in the world. And cobalt is central for electric batteries. So if you have an iPad or iPhone, or you drive a Prius, or you have a Tesla, or any kind of green energy that that is utilized, that green energy sector needs the batteries, and the batteries cannot function without the cobalt of the Congo. So here we see, again, the role that the resources on the African continent is playing in fueling the industries in the West, while the Africans continue to be dependent and impoverished and living in really bestial conditions and abject poverty as the technology sector, the electronic sector, the aerospace, military. Cobalt is also key for U.S. aerospace and military industries. It's a strategic mineral that's vital to the functioning of the U.S. aerospace and military industries. So it's in the interest of Europe and the United States to keep the African continent in an impoverished and dependent state so that the riches can continue to, and the natural resources can continue to flow out in their raw form to the West. And China has also gotten in on the game as well. Its rapid industrialization could not have happened without the copper and the iron and the cobalt from the African continent. And because China's gotten into the mix, the United States and Europe were caught off guard, and they're not able to compete with China economically on the African continent. So what they've done is bring out the great equalizer that the United States and the West has, which is its military. And in 2008, George Bush and Donald Rumsfeld established what they call AFRICOM, which is the Africa Command. You know, the U.S. has various commands throughout the globe. The latest one that they've developed is AFRICOM. And with AFRICOM, what has happened is that President Obama took the relay from President Bush and has accelerated exponentially the militarization of the African continent. So within the first year of President Obama getting into office, AFRICOM, the U.S. military presence, increased some 300% on the African continent. By the time we get to the end of the Obama term, it increased almost 2,000%. So today we have a military U.S. military presence in almost every country, in almost all of the 54 countries that we see on the African continent. And probably the apogee of the militarization of the African continent under the Obama administration came when the U.S. Bombed Libya. And for those of you who are participating in the Ireland conference, it was the AFRICOM and NATO that led the bombing of Libya. The bombing of Libya was a joint effort between the African Command and the North Atlantic Treaty Organization that resulted in the regime change that we saw in Libya. And probably in a grotesque fashion, we saw Hillary Clinton coming into Libya, really channeling you know, Julius Caesar. When Caesar said, I came, I saw, and I conquered. Hillary Clinton said, I came, I saw, and he died, referencing the overthrow of Colonel Gaddafi. And today, Libya is a mess. It's a failed state. And the weapons that came out of Libya as a result of the overthrow of the Gaddafi regime spread throughout West Africa. And we saw a blowback from that overthrow of Gaddafi and the spreading of weapons in the West African region. They called it Sahel, when U.S. soldiers were in last year were killed in Niger. And that was a direct result of what has had unfolded with the destabilization of the region through the bombing of Libya. So where are we today with this militarization of the African continent and the plundering of natural resources and the installation of what we call agents of neocolonialism? Well, the youth are rising up. Up to 60% of the African continent are young people, those who are 25 and under. And they are carrying on the tradition of the independence leaders like Patrice Lumumba and Thomas Sankara. So you have young people in Senegal, they're called Yanamar, and they're challenging their leaders and challenging the neocolonial order. You have young people in Burkina Faso called Ballet Citoyen. They got rid of the leader who assassinated Thomas Sankara. They overthrew, through mass protest and mobilization, Blaise Compaoré in 2014 in Burkina Faso. In the Congo, you have young people who are part of what they call the Telema movement, and they've been rising up to resist the new agents of neocolonialism that have been imposed on them. So we have strong social movements that are unfolding on the African continent. Just recently this spring, we saw in Ghana, where the United States are looking to establish a base there, you had students and labor union leaders in the streets resisting the imposition of a military presence in Ghana. So these are the young people and the social forces that we ought to be engaging in order, from our end, in order to support their efforts to resist neocolonial rule, to resist the imposition of leaders that don't represent the interests of the people, support those who are fighting for peace and who are fighting for justice and who are fighting for human dignity on the African continent. And that's the appeal that I would leave you with tonight, to stand in solidarity with those courageous and dignified social justice fighters on the African continent.
Well, Maurice, that was a most illuminating presentation over time and space of the African continent's history. I think I'd like to go now, Mary Beth, do you think, to questions that people might address to Maurice, and to learn more maybe about the historical perspective and the current perspective he presented, or specific topics or issues? Do you want to have people press number one? Is that on the key? Why don't you give the instructions?
Right.
You'll be better at that than I. Yeah.
Only because I've done it so much more, Nancy. Press number one on your phone keypad if you have a question for Maurice Carney. It's amazing to me that his presentation connected with just about every issue committee that we have at WILF, certainly the Corporations versus Democracy Issue Committee. The three C's that he talked about, civilization may not be a current theme, but certainly Christianity and commerce still are. I hope that people will think of some good questions and raise their hands. Right now we have two people on the stack. I'll start with Lorna Paisley. Lorna, your stack is open. Your mic is open.
Hi.
I just wanted to ask him, does he by any chance have a video or one of those other programs, TED, that a person could watch and give info and also pass on to other people? This is like, oh, here we go again, wrecking foreign countries for resources. And people don't know about this stuff either. So anyway, does he have a video or a TED or something?
Did you do a TED Talk, Maurice?
Hello, Maurice.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
We did a short film that it's a slice of what I just discussed. The website is congojustice.org, CONGOJUSTICE.org. Now, it focuses on the Congo, but it's emblematic of the continent as a whole. So that would be a good short video. And what I'll also do is I'll compile a list of videos that I'd send to Michael and Nancy that it can share with the group. Unfortunately, some of the videos that are in French are really good because we often focus on the U.S. presence in Africa, but the French presence is as insidious. But the videos are mostly in French. If I find a good French video with English subtitles, I'll also share that. But for right now, congojustice.org is a good start. And also, I know you have groupings throughout the U.S. What we're doing right now, we have a campaign that we're part of. We're co-hosting film screenings in different cities throughout the United States. We'll be in Berkeley on July 26th, in Boston on August 29th, and we'll be in a number of other cities, Atlanta. I can share, if people go to our website, friendsofthecongo.org, right on the homepage, there will be a slider there that takes you to the film. The film is called This is Congo, and it's being screened throughout the United States. So that's an opportunity to for people in different communities if they wanted to go to the theater where the film is being screened. And I can send more information out on that as well.
That's excellent.
We did post a lot of the links that you gave us to books and websites and videos on our text pad, Maurice, but we send out notes to these calls, and we'd be happy to include any others that you send us. So please send them to Nancy or Michael.
Okay, I will do.
And I would just like to can you hear me? Is my mic open?
Yes, it is.
Hello?
Yes, your mic is open.
Oh, yes,
Nancy.
It is. Okay. Maurice, you might also list the films that are in French only. I think some of our members read French or speak French, and so will understand. And
okay, fantastic.
Yeah.
I will.
Yeah.
Is there one French film that everyone really ought to see that looks at French colonialism in Africa?
Yeah, so I think that would be good. And images speak 1,000 words, too, sometimes. So people can, if they don't understand at all, the French at all, they can, the images will be very telling, I'm sure. I also might mention that at the No Foreign Bases conference in Baltimore, which you see on your text pad, you can listen to Maurice as well as his colleagues that spoke on the plenary panel number 6. I gave you that link. If you go then to the home page of noforeignbases.org, then the homepage comes up and the map comes up. And the upper left-hand corner of that square where the map is, you click on that and you can get the playlist of all the panels. And the playlist for this, panel number 6, is playlist number 9. And it's very well introduced by Ajamu Baraka, who founded the Black Alliance for Peace, and also earlier than that, he was a founder of the U.S. Human Rights Network, and of course, the vice presidential candidate for Jill Stein and the Green Party. And there you can listen to his excellent introduction and moderation, as well as the three panelists, including Maurice. So that would be a very good introduction to this topic, as well as other sorts of background to what Maurice just presented. I also want to say that at the conference in Baltimore, a resolution was passed to work together on convening a global conference, and that, as you see there, will take place in Dublin, November 16 to 18, and is going to be a very important global conference with representatives from the various regions of the world participating, and next steps toward closing U.S. military bases and NATO bases being taken, outlined and taken. And I'm sure there will be a very excellent panel on Africa as well. So I'll just close with that and go on to the next question.
We have a lot of other hands up now.
Yeah.
Goddard, you're on.
I just
Jonas
wanted to
from San Jose, California.
I just wanted to ask about the things that are on the text pad, and you all have gone way beyond that. And thank you, thank you, thank you. This is amazing. Thank you, Maurice, very much. And
you're welcome. Thank you.
Get it. Thank you.
And Carol Erner has her hand up. Carol, you're my
yes.
Carol,
my husband and I, but particularly my husband, were very involved with, actually Egypt also, but particularly with Libya. And he was the project director brought in to work on development plans when the U.S. had their big base there. And then when Gaddafi kicked it out, they kept my husband on to keep working on the development plan, which Gaddafi and his government adopted, and we're told carried it out almost to the crossing the T's and dotting the I's, but we've not been back to see it ourselves. We've been told how successful it was in bringing women out into the labor force, in free education for everyone, free medical care for everyone, and housing development for everyone, on and on. It was amazing what was done. Okay, so he died before the great bombing, which destroyed it all. And that would have hurt him very much. And my question is, where is any point of hope in Libya? Anyone that I could start exploring? You can send me an email via our hostess tonight or however. But anyone to contact to work on this, because my own heart is still with Libya. And we have a very different view of Gaddafi than our government promoted.
I see. Are you were you referencing to the Wheelis Air Base that was established in Tripoli? Is that what your husband worked on? Is that the one, or is it a different one?
He worked on the regional plan for the area which Tripoli was in. And he was the project director for that plan.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was made to just incorporate for all, was applied to all of Libya.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. To answer your question, Libya is so tough. It has been so dismantled that identifying a ray of hope there right now is very, very, very difficult because there's so many competing forces scrambling for control of the oil. As Gaddafi warned prior to the bombing, that there are a range of terrorist groups that would fill the vacuum, and that's what has happened. And the way that I know migration is an issue for the group as well. We see that being a major push factor, the destabilizing of Libya and the region, in pushing migrants out of Africa towards Europe. We saw advent of the trading, the slave trade that is taking place there, Africans coming from south of the Sahara, being seeking to go to Europe, being captured and traded. So it's really difficult to see a ray of hope unless you have the Sahel nations and the African Union. I know before the bombing, the African Union, led by Thabo Mbeki, former president of South Africa, were putting a plan, a peaceful plan, presenting it to the United Nations and to the U.S. and to the European nations, but they were roundly rejected. So it's just hard, really difficult. That's one of the tough spots right now to see a ray of hope, considering the multiplicity of forces and that are well armed and fighting to control different turf in Libya. It's just really difficult to identify any particular ray of hope. I know the U.S. is talking about multi-party democracy and pushing elections, but that's not a solution for Libya right now.
Thank you, Maurice. Michael has gone ahead and added the link to all of the videos that were from the Baltimore Close the U.S. Bases conference on the text pad. So it should be easy to find them there. And the next person is Laura Dewey with your hand up. Laura's from Detroit branch.
Hi, Maurice, thank you very much for this broad overview. It was excellent. I have a question about the young people. What forms of struggle are they able to participate in? For example, I imagine there may be street action, but also, are they able to participate in any of the democratic processes? Perhaps you could talk about Burkina Faso, since they helped to get rid of their leader, or the Congo. But anyway, I'm just curious about what forms of struggle are taking place among the young people.
Yeah, thank you for the question. Forms of struggle are varied. One of the channels that the youth are using is music and hip hop. That's been a major driver in terms of political education, where you have hip-hop artists who are conscious. In fact, the key leaders of the movement in Senegal, Yau Namar, are hip-hop artists, hip-hop and reggae artists. So when they hold concerts or they produce records, they have messages in their songs that raise the consciousness of the youth. The same with Burkina Faso, one of the leaders of the youth group there, Ballet Citoyen. His name is two of the leaders. One is his name is Smokey. He's a hip hop artist. Another one is Sam Ska. He's a reggae artist, and they're on the radio, not only spreading their music but injecting commentary. So music is a key vehicle for reaching the youth. In the Congo, music is also instrumental, where the artists are singing about corrupt politicians, singing about lack of fresh water, lack of jobs, and raising the question, why are we voting for these leaders if they're not delivering on health and on education and employment. So music is a key organizing tool. civil disobedience. The youth are having sit-ins. If you think about the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, initiatives of the early 19 and mid-1960s, that kind of organizing is taking place where youth are going into communities, educating the population, not only other young people, but the population at large, about their rights and responsibilities as citizens, not to sell their vote to politicians for T-shirts or for a bag of rice or a bag of sugar. So they're using political education. And then, of course, there is mass protests. Now, the mass protests that the youth are leading, particularly in the Congo, are a little more challenging because the government is firing live bullets at them, not just this tear gas and rubber bullets, but live bullets. So they know that every time they go out, one of them may not come back. In the last major demonstration in the Congo, one of the youth leaders, his name is Rossi Mukendi, he was gunned down when he was trying to close a church door because the security forces were firing tear gas into churches. And he was trying to protect the women, and he was shot and killed. So it's that kind of challenge that they face. But they're using the music, political education, grassroots organizing, going into communities. They're screening films in handicap centers for street children, in orphanages, films with political content. They're organizing with faith, labor groups, and other youth to organize protests, to, in some cases, some opposition figures to try and change the situation in their country. They're having debates about whether or not they should form political parties or run for office. Some groups, like in Senegal and in Burkina Faso, they've opted for being pressure group and remaining in the civilian sector and trying to hold the elected leaders accountable. In the Congo, some of the groups are saying, well, we need to run for office. We need to be engaged in the political process. So that we can actually have an impact on policy and change the material conditions of the masses of the people. So they're using a multiplicity of methods and strategies in order to try and change the situation.
Okay, I have two more questions, one from Sandy Thacker from East Bay, California, and the other from Nancy Price. Sandy, you're first. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi, thank you. And I also wanted to add my thanks to an incredible overview of African history. And it makes me feel ashamed of our country at how little people, young people, learn about African history, you know, in this country. And it's like a blackout of your history. So in that light, I'm wondering, you've given us a lot of information, a lot of places to go, but is there a place you can go for, like you're telling us all these things that, you know, about actions that are going on in those countries in Africa? Is there like a news stream or a newspaper online in English, but that kind of covers those issues specifically for the Congo and other African countries that you're connected with?
Yeah, that's a question I consistently get, and I haven't been able to establish one site in particular. But the site that's on the text pad that Michael has shared, pambazuka.org, is a good site to go to. You'll certainly see information about the Togolese youth movement, the resistance movement that's taking place in Togo today. Interestingly enough, these movements are something that you said. These movements these efforts are connected. As a result of what's happened, one of the things that's happening on the African continent right now is Israel is on a diplomatic offensive in Africa to try and get African leaders to support the Israeli state. even as it crushes the Palestinians. And there was a conference that was going to be held in an Israeli Africa conference that was going to be held in Togo last winter. But due to the resistance movement in Togo, the Togolese were trying to get rid of the 50-year dictatorship that's been imposed on them by one family that's backed up by the French. The resistance movement was so strong that the government had to cancel the summit that was going to be held among African nations and Israel, which accrued to a small victory to the benefit of the Palestinians. Because the extent to which you can push back on Israel securing African allies so that they can vote on behalf of Israel at the United Nations or provide Israel diplomatic cover, that's to the benefit of the Palestinians. That's just a way that to indicate how what unfolds on the African continent is connected to the larger, you know, global community and global peace and justice movement. But pambazooka.org is a good site to go to on a consistent basis. Also, if you're on Twitter, I would recommend, depending on the country you want to find out about, if you want to find out about Togo, you go on Twitter and you just use the hashtag or type in the search for Togo. Or if you want to find out about Senegal, you do the same. And you'll almost always see those who are most active appearing on Twitter and providing sources. So Twitter I've found to be a really good source. There's also All Africa, ALLAFRICA, allafrica.com. Is a decent source. It unfortunately has a lot of government sources, government propaganda on there, but you know, from going through, you can pretty much tell the narrative, pick up the narrative of the people. But that's another good source as well.
Thank you.
Nancy, I'm going to ask you to ask your question and then kind of lead us home because
yes, okay, yeah, I'd be glad to. So, Maurice, I was wondering how African radio is part of the peace and social justice movements, and also is there... What impact is the migration and conflict having on the ability for youth to organize and push back? Because it's certainly having an impact and creating unrest and conflict. So how does that aspect of what is going on presently impact the youth mobilization movements for peace and justice?
Sure. Thanks for the question. As it relates to radio, is an excellent tool for transmitting information on the continent. Interestingly enough, as it relates to continent-wide or across borders broadcasts, it's usually, for the most part, it's the Western radio that reaches the maximum number of people.
Uh-huh,
so
yeah.
You have BBC, for example, or Radio France International, or Voice of America. They're the ones that seem to have continent-wide reach. What we see, you would think the African Union would be spearheading an effort around communication, but as I shared in the presentation, the leaders of these African nations, for all intents and purposes, they're really agents of neocolonialism.
Yes.
And a movement from below is needed to push those leaders aside because Africa, it's the richest continent in the world. It has the natural resources. The Congo alone, just the Congo has an estimated $24 trillion in natural wealth there. So the resources are there. It's just that they're being siphoned out of the country, being sold off for pennies on the dollars, and they're not going towards building communications infrastructure, for example, for the continent, or to health and education and employment and all. So that's really the fight that's unfolding on the continent for those resources, those riches, to benefit the broader population. As it relates to the migration, that's a very complex question because you have most of the migration that's taken place in Africa, the people are going to other African countries. You know, so over the last year, 1.7 million people have been displaced in the Congo, and they wind up in Uganda or in Zambia or in Angola. And those who do make it to Europe, a small minority, it's just that they represent a small minority. Most of the folks who are displaced remain on the African continent, and a major part of the displacement, or a large part of the displacement, is the militarization of these societies. So what the United States does, it comes in with its military, and it supports these strongmen. And these strongmen use the equipment and the money that they get from the U.S. to suppress their population and to fuel conflicts in different parts of their country that push people out to either to other countries or push them into the bush where they try to survive. That's a really big part of the whole immigration debate that really needs to be included. What role is the militarization of Africa, the support of strong men, in the case of I know we're dealing about Africa with Africa, but the case comes squarely home in looking at Latin America. We see how U.S. destabilizes Latin American governments and how that serves as a push factor for migration and sending people to the U.S. So the same thing happens on the African continent, just that most of the people who are pushed out of their land and their homes, they go to other African countries. Some of them make it to Europe, and of course some make it to the U.S. The first lady that was acknowledged of having her child taken away from her in the detention centers here in the U.S., she was a Congolese refugee. So it would be good to see that element, those forces that push these push people off their land and out of their countries, be entered into the debate as well and discussion.
And so make the intercontinental connection so that we can really see what global forces are at work and the impact of these global forces on local populations and local societies and politics and economies. So
absolutely. So when you talk about immigration, you have to talk about militarization of the global south, you know, by the U.S. and by European and by NATO.
Yeah, exactly. So, well, I guess there are no more questions.
Nancy, I just wanted to say that so much of the story of what's happened in Africa is similar to what we've read about in other countries in Naomi Klein's shock doctrine. And we're seeing so much of these policies of strongmen using repression and militarization against their own people right here in the United States now. So it's all coming home to roost. So it's very relevant and, of course, very connected to Africa's struggle. So.
Absolutely. So I think it's I think I would speak for everybody on the call, Maurice. Thank you so very much for educating us about a continent of 54 nations that is so complex, socially, politically, culturally, in terms of ethnic groups and religions, and this is just a start.
Languages,
and this is just a start for Wilf, and I hope we can have you back to give us a part two. Maybe after the Congress, we would have some of the people who are on the Congress on a call, and we can have a follow-up with you as well. So I thank you very much. I thank Michael and Mary Beth and Sandy and all the others who helped make these calls a great success.
Yeah,
Michael,
thank you. It's been my pleasure. Thank
Michael
you very much.
Michael, I wanted to say that we did post the link to the video of Maurice Kearney at the conference, his panel, on the textpad. That textpad is now loaded with links and resources, so be sure and take a look at it, and we will send it out to you all, everyone who has been on the call as well. The video, Michael, yes, to the video of his channel at the Baltimore conference is posted on the text pad. So there we go.
So I'm going to say good night and thank you for everybody on the call. This is Nancy.
Sandy, do you want to wind us up, please?
Well, I just want to, again, thank you, especially Maurice, for taking the time to enlighten us tonight. And I think everyone on this call would agree with Nancy that it would be wonderful to have you come back and follow up, especially after a number of our members will have gone to Ghana and have that experience. And we'd like to follow up on this conversation. So thank you very much. That's the end of our call for now, but if you'd like to continue the dialogue a little longer, you can stay on for our soapbox segment following the close. A reminder that our next One Wilf call will be on Thursday, August 9th. Michael, please open the mic so everyone can say goodnight, and then we'll go right into the soapbox segment.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good
night. Thank you all.
Good night,
good night.
Everybody.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.
Thank you. Good night.
Okay, we'll go into the soapbox section. I see that Barbara Nielsen had a question that we did not get to answer. I'm sorry, Barbara. I was trying to tend to the script and get everybody shepherded on to the next phase. Perhaps we can send Maurice your question and get an answer from him by email.
Is Barbara still on?
Yeah.
Oh, hi. Oh,
Barbara.
What was your question going to be for Maurice? Wasn't that a great presentation?
It was amazingly good. My question was I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Did I say something wrong?
No.
Oh. My question was about the G5 Sahel and his thoughts on its effectiveness. And he mentioned it in passing, but I had technical difficulties for most of his presentation. I was not able to get on. So I don't know, did he talk about that coordinating organization in West Africa?
No, he didn't in specifics.
Okay.
I will send you his email, or maybe it's there on the text pad, I don't remember. And you could perhaps ask him that.
Thank you. I may well do that
yeah.
Because I think it's an issue. It's a coalition, if you don't know, it's a coalition of governments, and it's a lot of the northern countries above Ghana, but not Ghana, not including Ghana, yeah, a coalition. So thank you very much. This was an extraordinary presentation, by the way. Very, very wonderful that you all thought of doing it.
Yeah.
We have both Nancy and Michael to thank for that, and Ajamu Baraka, who recommended Maurice. And I think we all agree he was an excellent choice.
Well, yes,
so,
indeed.
Does anybody else have a question or comment? You want to talk about anything at all about the Hiroshima video at the beginning of the call, or the Hiroshima events, the solidarity events that we have planned that people reported on, the ICE detention actions that are being planned? If you have a question or comment, just raise your hand by pressing number one and we'll call on you. I'm really grateful that everybody showed up, so many people showed up for this call, because it would have been a shame to miss it. And I'm a little sorry that Courtney Linen and her sister, Camille Dantzler, were not able to be here, since they have both been, Courtney leads our racial justice working group, and Camille has a PhD in African studies. So I think their contributions would have been really interesting, but I think they're dealing with some illness in their family. So, I'll make sure to let them know that we'll send them the audio link and ask them to.
Oh yes,
to listen.
Very good. Yeah,
that's good. Yeah. This is Joan, and Joan Goddard, and I'm going to have to get off the phone. But thank you, everybody, very much.
Thanks, Joan. Have a good night.
Good night. Thank you.
Mary Bricker Jenkins, how are things going with the rest of the Poor People's Campaign plans? Have they come up with some next steps that they're working on?
Actually, the statewide coordinators met on a national basis yesterday, so there will be some developments soon, but I don't have any specific information.
Okay. Well, it's a huge campaign to shepherd, and they're probably exhausted from the 40 days of action. So, understandable.
Indeed. I will say that some of the youth leaders had a videoed conference that I saw part of on YouTube, and they were just so incredible, so spirited, so knowledgeable, that I don't know if anything like that was happening when I was in my 20s. I think if there had been something like that happening on this on the wide basis that they represented, we'd probably be a very different world today. So stay tuned, because these young folks are going to lead us in the direction we've been wanting to go for a long time.
Well, this is Nancy. I was thinking, as Maurice was talking about the youth movements in Africa, that is exactly what's happening in the U.S. And
yes,
and it's what we really need to link to. Not that the older generation doesn't have a great deal to offer as well, but we have to join forces here across age and all the other dimensions, so that we can win soon. The change that we need.
Yeah, Nancy, I agree totally with that, and I think that whatever we can do to make that happen, we absolutely must do. One of the things that is notable to me is that I don't pick up from this phalanx the resentment or disregard of elders.
Yes, I would agree with you. Yeah,
they listen. They ask questions. They're respectful, as well as bringing their own perspectives to us in a very respectful way. So, I have tremendous hope. And that, by the way, if you go, if you're interested in seeing it, you just go on the Poor People's Campaign Facebook page, and there is a link there to the youth conversation.
Oh, great. Terrific. Great. Well, I'll be on the call tomorrow and look forward to all the reports.
Thank you so much, Nancy, for this. I mean, just absolutely wonderful.
Yes. Well, I'm very embarrassed that in the small article I wrote for the Peace and Freedom magazine, for some reason I thought Ghana was the first colony to win independence, and as he was saying, it was Sudan, and I must apologize somehow. I don't know how I misinterpreted what I was reading.
Well, I would have thought it was Ghana also.
Well,
so
I'm actually.
Go
ahead.
I just pasted some information from the Santa Cruz branch on the text pad as well. They're talking about information that people could use for the immigration and detention action. So,
oh, good.
Take a look at it.
Oh, great. Good. Well, I'm going to sign off, folks, and have some dinner.
Sounds good. Well done, y'all.
Okay, thank you, everybody. Talk tomorrow.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Yeah. Good night. Good night. I guess that's everything. If no one else has anything to say, we'll...
Julie.
Can you hear me?
Hi,
Julie.
Hi.
Yes, go ahead.
How are you doing? I just wanted to say... Oh, good, good. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Wonderful. I just wanted to say thank you so much for this amazing call. Everything like Nancy and Maurice was talking about, for me, like, I'm still processing a lot of it because that's like all that type of information in Africa and stuff like that is like the kind of like a lot of the stuff that I'm very passionate about with racial justice and everything and where our conversation is going in wealth in general with regard to racial justice, I think is like in a really good place right now, and I'm just like, I'm really excited about us, you know, being involved in that, and I just thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. I agree with what Nancy and Mary BJ said about these young African resistors and demonstrators giving us new inspiration and showing us how we might respond to this kind of more recent oppression that we've seen in this country, but it's the same as we've seen historically in other countries. And you know, that Shock Doctrine book I keep going back to, they made it so clear that while American militarization and command activity is the excuse for it is usually about law and order and protecting people and all of that, it's most often about plunder, gaining resources, and it occurs very. I was struck when Carol Erner was talking about the Libya situation, because when these nations begin to do economic policies that prioritize people over profit, when they do universal health care, when they do fair banking, when they do price controls that equalize wages and prices of commodities, that is when you see the United States turning all of its wolves loose on those countries, because more than anything else, that is what we cannot abide. It threatens threatening capitalism, and the last taboo, apparently.
Well,
striking.
You just said all of that very nicely, making all those connections. That was awesome. And kind of like how you were saying about that what the youth are doing in Africa, and like having that kind of like pick up, around the rest of the world and in America would, gaining awareness to that, and like how he was saying that they're teaching a lot through song, for example, like stuff like that. I feel like for me is something that I think would be helpful to help move this whole, thing along, with getting people more aware and everything, wanting to actually succeed in doing all of this.
Yes, we had, during the 60s, we had so many singers and musicians and artists who were really committed to social change, and we haven't, maybe I'm just not aware of them, but we haven't seen that many of them in this decade.
Yeah, it's definitely much more scattered, and not everyone knew the Beatles. Everyone knew,
Bob Dylan.
Exactly.
I see that Chuck Jagoda has joined us from Palo Alto. I think this might be Chuck's first One Wolf call. Chuck, I heard from Cheryl that Roberta from your branch was unable to get on because of some technical difficulties. I hope that you'll let her know that we apologize for that, and we'll try in the future to do better. How did you think the call went? Let's hear from you.
Fine. It is my first one, and I sort of came in the middle before a man from Africa gave his presentation, but I think it's fine. I'll definitely tune in again.
Oh, good. That's what we like to hear. Tell all your friends.
Yes. Okay. And in fact, I have a new friend in Santa Cruz that I recently met, and I think I'm going to tell her about the Santa Cruz branch. I think would be a perfect match for the branch and for her.
Well, good. That's what.
Yeah.
Those are the kind of connections we hope for with these calls. So, good. Very good.
Yes. Thank you.
All right. Well, I don't see any other hands up. For the good of the order, does anyone else have anything that they want to ask or say or report on or?
Good call.
I also see Philip Cole. I think this is also his first call. Philip, I'm not sure where you're from, but why don't you let us hear your voice and tell us what you thought of the call?
Am I on now?
Yes, you are.
I found it very interesting.
Where are you from, Philip?
I live in Daly City, California, part of the San Francisco branch.
Oh, okay.
Second year in the organization. And I was wondering how many people are aware of sometimes in Africa, since the subject was on that particular continent, sometimes charitable efforts of this country destroys local indigenous industries in some countries in Africa. And an example would be clothes that are donated to Goodwill are bundled up and sold by the ton to brokers in Africa. And then they are sold on the streets of African countries. And it has served to destroy the indigenous apparel industries in some countries in Africa, putting women out of work in those local industries in Africa.
Very good point. Very good point, Philip.
And hopefully one day, people will address that particular problem, because a lot of people who donate to Goodwill and Good Conscience here do not realize that they're contributing to the destruction of jobs and ways for people to feed their families in Africa. And it turns a lot of people, instead of producers in Africa, into just salesmen, street salesmen.
Yeah, I think of that sometimes when I think about Tom's Shoes, because they have people donate shoes to these developing countries. And, the first thought that occurred to me when I heard that is, don't they have shoemakers there? But apparently that's not a consideration for us, and it really should be.
Yeah, and so I think with everyone enjoying the talk, I think there's, at some point, hopefully in the future, as a group, people will address this issue here and put pressure on some of the charities that contributed to this problem. And
right.
Also, there's no such thing as blood-free diamonds, by the way.
True. Your co-member in San Francisco, Barbara Nielsen, had her hand up. Barbara, go ahead.
I don't know how it got up. I just took it down.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
That's all right.
All right.
Well, thank you for the invitation to speak, and I enjoyed the conference call altogether.
Well,
good
I
night.
I hope this won't be your last call, Philip. Join us every month.
Well, thank you so much. Bye.
Great. Bye. So, well, I think that's probably it. It's just after 9 a little bit, and
Mary Beth, did we hear from Margaret at all? Quietly, patiently being on the call.
Hi, Margaret. How are things in Tucson? And what did you think of the call?
Oh, just fine. Oh, I thought it was wonderful, especially, everybody was good, and particularly Maurice. I think this gave us some insight that I don't know if I've ever had a chance to be exposed to before, especially about the... I mean, we hear so much about the Holocaust with its 6 million genocide of the Jews, but it sounds like if they've had exactly the same, well, not exactly the same thing, but the same kind of numbers in the Congo.
Yeah, millions and millions, yeah.
Yeah. And
didn't
so
you
that
say
was
it was
big.
Like, I think like 50 million people? Like,
mm-hmm.
It was a huge
yeah.
number that he...
Did he say, yeah, many, many more, I guess, because we don't hear about that. And my son recently, well, within the last year or two, reminded me, if I had ever known before, because it wasn't really ever focused upon in school, was the Armenian genocide. How many of us
right.
really were aware of that way back when? And so there are all these things that aren't really illuminated quite the same way. That some are.
It's true. And they say who writes the history controls the history.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The only person who hasn't spoken yet is
Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Margaret. I'm sorry.
Oh, I just wanted to thank you all the time for coordinating all of this, Mary Beth. It's just fabulous. I've really always enjoyed the calls. I shouldn't say enjoyed. I've been very edified. I like the fact that we all
hope
get
they're enjoyable, though. We hope people are enjoying them. And really, I can't take credit for tonight at all. This was all Michael and Nancy, and with help from Ajamu Baraka for putting it together. Uh-huh. But it certainly was one of our best calls, I would say.
Oh, it's been terrific. Thank you so much. Oh, the other thing I wanted to ask you, do you know, I was very, very pleased when I saw the invitation to this call about the conference in Dublin, about no to the U.S. NATO bases. So do you think that they'll, I was kind of pleasantly surprised that Wolf was even getting involved so much in that. And do you know if there'll be, what kind of a contingent, if any, from the U.S. Wolf will be going?
Go ahead.
This would be to Dublin in November.
No, go ahead, Mark. Barbara, you're at the Disarm Committee. You would have a much better idea than I do.
Well, we will have people. There will be people not only from Wolf U.S., but I think there will be people from other sections in Wolf. But Nancy Price, who was one of the coordinators and participants in the Baltimore conference, out of which the Dublin conference grew, will definitely be there. And I anticipate that there will be others like Anne Wright, who is a Wolf member, and Leah Bolger, I believe, is going to be there. So there will be Wolf members there, and Wolf members will be participating to put it on in various ways as well. Military bases and NATO military bases are something that our Reaching Critical Will project has been involved in. And, of course, our foreign military bases are really not consistent in terms of supporting the Women, Peace, and Security agenda, which is something that Wolf is very much involved in. So the real numbers aren't yet known, but we do know that Nancy Price is definitely going to be there and participating and bringing different complexities to the table, including the environmental issues.
But I know that they're inviting other people from Wolf to go, Margaret. So if you or anyone from your branch is interested, take a look at that TextPad link. And I'm pretty sure that there's a place to register to go. Who wouldn't want to go to Dublin?
Who wouldn't want to go to Dublin? Although November might be a little cold. But
might be a little chilly.
Yeah. But no, it's open to the public, and they would welcome. There was such a terrific response in Baltimore and interest by other people. There were people there from outside the United States in Baltimore. I think that was one of the reasons that they decided that this was time, because a lot of people in Europe in particular are not happy at all with the U.S. bases and the NATO bases. So it should be a very interesting and hopefully productive conference.
So the only person left in the... Oh, go ahead, Margaret. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I've talked enough. Go ahead.
Oh, no. I don't want to shut you down. Please say what you're going to say.
I just wondered if Madeline Reese might be there. Is she still Secretary General?
She is still Secretary General. I spoke with her on Monday at the International Board meeting, and I was on that call because I'm going to be working on the international resolutions for Wolf in Ghana, actually. I will be there at that conference. Unclear whether Madeline will be able to go, but this would definitely be the kind of conference that one would expect to see her at.
Sure. Well, I doubt if we'll be able to go to Ghana at this point. I'm sorry to miss it, because we did get to go to The Hague a few years back, and it was wonderful meeting everyone then. But anyway, so I'm glad that you're going to Ghana, aren't you?
I am. I am very fortunate.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yes. So, but I won't. I'm sorry.
I'll just be glad to hear all your report when you get back.
I'll be very happy to do so. But Mary Beth, you keep starting to ask Anne for her comments, so I'm sorry I jumped in.
I was trying to get to Anne. Anne, you're the last person in the soapbox.
Oh, I thought it was an excellent call, and you're really too modest because you always do a ton of work regardless of who finds the speakers, and so thank you. I think everyone found it very, very educational and also motivating.
Well, it was encouraging to me that we had, I think at one point, 32 people on the call, and I think we only lost 3 or 4 of them when the call went on a while. Everybody seemed riveted, and Maurice was just really wonderful to listen to. So.
He was. Amazing amount of information he could convey in 20, 30 minutes.
I had to smile when he started with, in 1400.
Right.
the slave trade went on between 1400 and 1800, and blah 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 blah. And I thought, wow, that goes back a lot farther than I thought it did.
Thank you again, Mary Beth, for everything that you have done. And this is going to be a hard act to follow for next call. However, on the one hand, on the other hand, you all keep pulling things out of hats and bringing great interest in each subsequent call. So I look forward to more.
I'm trying really hard to get Ricky Gard Diamond for August, the author of Screwnomics, to be at least on a small portion of the call. And in September, I hope that we'll have a segment to hear from our delegates to Ghana how it went. So things to look forward to.
Nice. Well, thank you again. I'm going to say goodnight. And thank you, Michael, for all your technical support and guru capabilities on these calls.
Yep. Thank you for everyone. Thank you, everyone, particularly Michael and Mary Beth. Good night. Take care.
Good night.
Good night, Michael. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good
night. Good
night. Good night, everybody.
And you're very welcome, everyone. It's an honor and a pleasure to help.
All right. Take care.
You too.
Hello.
Hi.